I'm pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University here in Fremantle, I think, Martin.
Yes, it's always good to be here in Fremantle, and a lot of anticipation, I gather, in Fremantle with the lead up the footy finals, but maybe we'll breach that later. But we've got a range of other things to talk about in the meantime.
Well, there's a lot of people who do want to paint the streets purple, and the Fremantle Shipping News has done that in its Freo Today feature this morning. Although it says not yet, but you know, we're getting there. Where they don't seem to be getting anywhere, Martin, as far as I can tell, is in the Ukraine and Gaza. We've talked about it a lot. There are a lot of terrible hotspots all around the world, and we fail to focus on all the others. Perhaps one day we'll draw up a list of all the others. But Ukraine and Gaza, what would you say the latest position is in Ukraine?
I think there is some crystallization around what either side wants. So in the case of Russia, they're pretty adamant they want land, and they want to keep various parts of eastern Ukraine in the Donbass region, as it's known. And that might even include Ukraine ceding some parts that they've still been defending. In the case of Ukraine and Europe, they are very adamant about security guarantees. They want to ensure that Russia can't just do this again. And that's where the focus, the latest focus of conversation is there in Europe. And they had a big coalition of the willing meeting that we've talked about in the past, Michael. That has ramifications for us because this informal group, it seems to be, includes Australia. And so this coalition of the willing is apparently prepared to put boots on the ground in Ukraine to stop Russian aggression in the future. And that could involve Australian soldiers, presumably. So that was an interesting discussion point that hasn't been probably as explicitly communicated before.
Well, we sort of sit with bated breath. I wouldn't be surprised if we got a sudden announcement sometime soon, but we've probably said things like that before. What about Gaza? What would appear to be the latest?
Well, you know, it's still looking pretty bleak. So Israel's continuing its assault on Gaza City. And, you know, that's you can see the outcomes of that. And there's still awful reports coming out of Gaza. There's been some discussion around the place about potential peace agreement. It's not clear that they've made a lot of progress around that. There was talk about a sort of partial agreement that saw half the remaining hostages being released and a cessation of hostilities for the time being. But I'm not convinced that the two parties are there yet. I think things still look pretty bleak in Palestine.
As we've said in the past, Martin, once upon a time, particularly post the Second World War, it was the US. The US was the main player. But for all that, and for the lowering of the Iron Curtain, as it used to be known, at the USSR, we never expected them to disappear completely, I suppose, although there was a time when we thought there might be things that looked like democratic republics created. But we always knew China was coming, at least I did, from the time I was a relatively small boy at primary school. China was always this, not looming danger, but looming fascination for me. And it's sort of been brought to a head recently, just in this last week, with President Xi having all of these people, President Putin, Prime Minister Modi from India, the North Korean leader, whole stack of people was there, quite a big show, a couple of meetings, including one to celebrate, from the Chinese point of view, the 80th year of the end of the war, and lots of new hardware and missiles and goose-stepping, and pretty impressive, if you like that sort of thing, Martin. But what does it all mean? We'll come to why Dan Andrews, the former Victorian Premier, was there, but what does it all mean?
Well, this has been quite an interesting story and kind of dominated the international relations scene over the last week or so. So notionally, China was celebrating the 80th anniversary of their defeat of Japan in World War II. That sounds pretty reasonable. And they invited, obviously, leaders from all over the place. Basically, no Western leaders turned up, though, Michael, which perhaps indicates that growing divide that's occurring. You mentioned the Cold War. I don't think we're quite at the Cold War yet, but you did have a situation where you've got a range of leaders throughout Asia and in other places like Iran and Russia, but no one from Western Europe, no one from the US or North America. Yeah, quite a divide there. We had no official representatives. We might come to some unofficial people that were there. But it was interesting because this was a flexing of muscles by President Xi. But he at the one time he talked about peace and security and harmony and people getting along in his main speech. But of course, the key feature of the day was this giant military parade that involved all manner of weapons, some of which looked pretty very modern and innovative. I think there was a bit of attention to robot dogs, for example, that appeared at one stage, and some drones and other devices. So that obviously was a main subject of discussion as well. And there were a range of people. The other watch, of course, was who was he hanging out with, Michael? And the two guys front and center in his entourage was Putin and Kim Jong-un from North Korea.
It's fascinating to watch, isn't it? Martin, I alluded to the cultural dominance of the US for most of my lifetime. So when I was a kid, Hollywood movies and things that came out of Hollywood and three-speed bicycles and you name it, America seemed to be the one place you'd want to go. But there's China now. After this big meeting in Beijing, I couldn't help but wonder what the world would feel like if you replaced the US's cultural domination with that of China. So I thought, who better to ask than the clever brains, the minds behind Copilot, one of the AI agents, and came up and put up on Fremantle Shipping News an article titled, Imagine If, not the first flag, but the second. And I had the two flags next to each other, the US on the left and the Chinese on the right. It's a really fascinating read because you change your whole cultural perspective and what life might be like. But none of that sort of worrying thinking, if it's worrying, bothered either Bob Carr, former Australian Foreign Minister and Premier of New South Wales, who did turn up but kept out of the pictures, and Dan Andrews, who also turned up but figured largely in the pictures, including with a number of the people you've mentioned. What were they doing there, and is it a good idea?
I think they've both got contacts there. I mean, it's worth mentioning that even though these guys have been ex-premiers and Bob Carr was a former foreign minister of Australia, they are going in their own private capacity. So Bob Carr runs a think tank which has close links to China, and I think he likes sort of bolstering his contacts over there. And we're told that Dan Andrews has business interests and is working in advocacy and consultancy. And of course, in China, if you want to do that well, you've got to flout your connections to the government. And so, no doubt, it serves him privately quite well to be shaking hands with President Xi. So, all of that might make sense from a private perspective, but it copped a lot of flak here in Australia, in particular, Dan Andrews. And he was accused of being a propaganda piece for President Xi, to be standing side by side with all these dictators.
Well, it's certainly good for him to be able to pull out the photo when he is talking to Chinese companies and Chinese CEOs, because it would have been so easy for President Xi to say, "Why is that guy in our photo? Tell him to move." But he didn't.
It was weird that he was there. It didn't really belong. This was the photo of world leaders predominantly. I should say, though, that two very prominent former prime ministers of New Zealand were also in that same entourage. So Helen Clark and John Key, who are probably two of their biggest luminaries, were both there. So he wasn't alone.
Well, I mean, I have to say, and we've sort of both said it before, you simply can't ignore China. As I said in my earlier comments, it's been coming forever. Population with billions was always going to become an economic powerhouse once they got themselves organised. They had all sorts of pitfalls and problems along the way, but my goodness, you can't ignore them. And there are big stories about how good their AI is because they've been hacking most of the rest of the world and getting information on all of us, it seems, private citizens. But What comes next, do you think, for President Xi, or is it really just positioning himself for whatever comes next?
I think certainly he wants to project the image of strength and that he is a legitimate contender with the US president for hegemony. I think that's important. And then he's got a range of projects that he's seeking to build. So there's this Belt and Road Initiative where he's bringing everyone closer into his economic orb. And then there's a range of geopolitical issues like Taiwan and the South China Sea that he wants to advance. So there's a longer term strategic objectives for Xi as well.
Well, it's as if President Trump has received a message on high, because as we sit and talk here this morning in Fremantle, Friday morning, Martin, breaking news from the US that the old Department of Defense has become the Department of War. Not for the first time, it was the Department of War until relatively soon after the Second World War, but there's some signals there, surely.
Yeah, it is interesting because the same administration says that he's firmly committed to peace, of course. Now, but the two are not mutually, to be fair to Trump, they're not mutually exclusive because his idea is you get peace through strength. So you project strength and toughness and you intimidate people into presumably backing off or making peace when you expect them to. That's his strategy, and he sort of kind of articulated that along the way. And previously, they've said, "Oh, I just don't want all of the military to get into this DEI stuff. All I'm interested in is fighting battles, Michael." So I can see why he's done that, I guess, from his perspective.
Well, it, as you suggest, though, seems to run counter to an isolationist view of the world. In the first Trump presidency, it seemed that it was very much isolationist this time. And we've had the Monroe Doctrine again: don't get too close to us and we'll push you out. But Department of War sends a clear message: we're not here just to defend. And we, as you say, we'll solve problems if we have to by striking out. What will the Americans do in the face of these apparent new pieces of military hardware? Some of them are said to be nuclear missiles that would drag through Tiananmen Square.
This move away from isolationism, I think, is quite fascinating, Michael. I mean, here's an example. He had the heads of Azerbaijan and Armenia in the White House signing a document for peace. Okay, that's not what he would have done in the first term, I think. I think he phoned up Pakistan and India when they were on the brink of war. So he is throwing himself in the middle of conflicts from time to time. I think he probably does want that Nobel Peace Prize, Michael.
Well, it might be
I don't know
said.
if he'll get it, but
It might be said in some sort of paradoxical way. At least you know what's going on with Trump. He's busily wearing his heart on his sleeve, telling us things, renaming the Gulf of Mexico, renaming his department to Department of War, and he does change his view from time to time. So you can't be sure how long you'll think of something. But if you want to find stuff out in Australia at the moment, under the Freedom of Information legislation, it's going to get harder and harder, Martin. It's been announced that the federal government, despite wanting to be transparent about things, are in fact making it harder. You have to pay to make an application. They're going to extend the confidentiality sections. They just generally don't seem to be in favour of telling the citizens what's going on. You can't make an anonymous application anymore. If you're in a sensitive position or a whistleblower, you can't do that. You think there'll be a outcry from the citizenry, not just the Centre for Public Integrity, to which I belong.
I think this is a really disappointing development and very frustrating for those of us that do take a strong interest in government decisions and why they're made and seek accountability. This is going to make that much, much harder. So I think it's really disappointing. I suspect both the government and opposition will try and collude on some of these things because it suits them when they're in government. But in the meantime, people that are demanding scrutiny are the ones that miss out. I don't expect the public to really take a strong interest in this, sadly, but I do expect them to be disadvantaged whether they realise it or not, because there's be more and more means of gov for government to avoid scrutiny.
Martin, you mentioned at the outset that there are lots of things happening in Fremantle. I mentioned that the road eventually might be painted purple down the centre of Fremantle through the Cappuccino Strip. But there's a lot more going on here as well. In fact, just finishing a major national cruise industry conference upon which the Shipping News has posted. I was very kindly invited by the National Association to attend, and WA's to see an increase in its cruise industry activity. So that's interesting at an economic level. It's also good for Fremantle, getting a lot of people here. And the port, of course, is meant to be, so far as its container terminal is concerned, going south to Kwinana. Not a lot of people, well, many people are not happy with that. And maybe this is reflected in the fact that forthcoming Freo elections, which are held on the 18th of October, we now have five mayoral candidates announced overnight. And there are contests in each of the four wards of the city, save for one, where Fedele Camara hasn't been challenged and he's returned. But from where you sit around Fremantle, watching what's happening, having been involved in mayoral debates before, five mayoral candidates, Martin, terribly interesting development.
It is. Many of the debates we've had have only had two candidates. That's been a common one. Occasionally, there's been three. And I think you have to go back to about 2010. There might have been five or six, I think. So that's the last time we've had a field as big as this. So we've got competition. Competition's always healthy, Michael. We'll be in touch. On the Shipping News very shortly, Michael, with a date for the mayoral debate. I think that'll be really exciting. And so, voters can tune in for that. But I expect that the mayoralty to be fairly hotly contested with those candidates. And as you said, we've got a fairly, except with the exception of Central Ward, we've got some lively competitions at ward level as well. And you've diagnosed the issue here. I think there is a lot of forks in the road when it comes to Fremantle's future, particularly the economic future of Fremantle and the choices that are being made in the local community.
Well, the Shipping News just this morning, pretty hot off the press, has an article up. They're off and racing in the 2025 Freo LGA Stakes. Councillor Fedele Camara canters home alone in Central, and then we go on to deal with it. The mayoral candidates are actually an interesting and a pretty well-known group in the order that they will appear on the voting slip. Ben Lawver, who's currently on council. Maria Wojcik, who isn't currently on council but has previously been there. Mark Woodcock, I don't think Mark's been on the council, but he's well known, particularly around the North Ward area. Hannah Fitzharding, who's the current mayor, is very well known. And Jenny Archibald is very well known, currently the deputy mayor and a previous mayor going back some time. So they're not a group without their supporters individually, Martin, I suspect.
There's a high profile candidates who've already had a fair bit to say, and so I think it will be a competitive race, and I'm looking forward to it, and we should be looking forward to the debate when it happens. I think it'll be really a good one.
Maria Wojcik seems to be sort of covering her bets by also standing in the coastal ward, but you don't see that with the other candidate. Also in the North Ward, Mark Woodcock has put his hand up there as well. So there are a couple of them are saying, well, if I don't get elected mayor, I'd still like to be on the council. But I don't believe we see that from either Hannah Fitzharding or from Ben Lawler. So it's pretty much a straight out elimination final in that case. Martin, very much like the Fremantle Dockers tomorrow night playing the Gold Coast Suns. I don't know how the Suns will go in all of this deluge of rain we're about to have, though, Martin.
It might be a bit unusual for them, the weather. And I think someone says that the Dockers haven't lost in the wet this year.
Oh, don't say
So
that. Don't say that.
it might be putting a mocker on them. But I think there's going to be a lot of eyes on that contest. So there's the contest happening in October for the mayoralty, but there's another contest happening on Saturday night that'll get a lot of interest.
Martin, I think on that note, hopefully interest being a word which really subtly means great victory for Fremantle Dockers, we can bring this view from the roundhouse to an end. The topics we've talked about today are really quite interesting ones, and I'm sure we'll revisit them over the next little while, once again in the case of a number of them. But thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure as always.